Welcome to the Impact Conversations, a Nijrode podcast. I am Brechtje Spijkerman.
And I am Janan Amelink. In this podcast series, we discover the stories behind the researchers and their work.
We believe that education and research at Nijrode serves a purpose in society, shaping responsible leaders.
We like to share what impact Nijrode research has made on society. Let's go.
Hey, Jan Anne.
Hey.
We have a good topic today.
I'm really excited.
But it's, yeah, me too. But it's also challenging, right? So how are we going to connect these topics? So we have a common ground.
Yeah, so we have a common ground in they all wrote or wrote books.
Right, textbook.
Yeah.
And they changed the world. So the innovation is around what the impact was of that textbook on students and on organizations.
But they wrote them in very different fields, because you have Jopan Rioli, who's a senior lecturer here and a PhD candidate, and he wrote more about entrepreneurship and financing.
Yeah, and he knows everything about venture funding. And also we have Professor Henry Robben, professor of marketing at Nijrode University. His topics are strategic marketing, innovation management, new product development. And a third...
Yeah, if that's not already enough, we have one more person... which is Dr. Letizia Alvino, and she changed the game with neuromarketing.
Really interesting topic, don't you think?
Yeah, it's going to be a wild conversation, I think.
Well, let's start.
Let's go.
The most important topic is how to write a textbook that became a huge success.
Fine, huge.
I haven't written any textbook.
You didn't write any textbook?
No, so far.
Not yet.
Not yet,
working on it. Well, I read the message of the book, entrepreneurs do not need funding from the US to become successful.
Kind of a tagline. Yes, thank you.
Good tagline. Please explain. Are we talking about big companies, scale-ups? Is this a widespread thought amongst companies? Because I didn't know.
No, it's actually, the point is that that's how my book originated. It's like... the book that I wrote, The Entrepreneurial Finance, The Art and Science of Growing Ventures, is all about a European perspective on entrepreneurial finance. So when I was looking for a book, for a textbook to help me in my classes for my students, I actually did not come across a book that could really help me, because all the books were A, outdated, B, had a very kind of traditional mindset in terms of pushing content instead of creating a pool for students, instead of creating interaction. And see, they were all like idealizing the Silicon Valley setting.
Well, in fact,
in Europe, we have so many great examples. So the tagline refers to the latter one. It's like, we have so much great things happening in Europe.
Yeah.
And it's almost any other textbook, if you read it, it's almost like, if you're really serious about entrepreneurship, why don't you go to US? Well, in fact, we have enough examples here. So that's why the book kind of gathers those people's, those insights, both the practice and the science behind it.
Funnily enough, because I don't want to give you a hard time with the first question and then the second one, but there's also, you mentioned China. There's new grounds to discover because China showed some interest.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So that refers to, actually, it's... The translation is already done. So China expressed interest, and they have translated the book, or I think 70% of the chapters, and it's translated now. There will be a Chinese edition of our book will come out in China. It'll be out in January, February. So it's really, really quick.
Wow.
And the point is that what you see in China is that there is some feeling and some... Also, some feeling yet to get people become more entrepreneurial. And this may help them to kind of make those steps, to kind of cross those bridges.
The mindset.
To help them in the mindset, but also cross the bridges in terms of like, how do I get from the thoughts, from thinking entrepreneurial to actually realizing and getting investors on board.
And wouldn't that assume that the thinking that is European is similar to the thinking that entrepreneurs do in China? When it comes to financing?
No, it does not. The point is actually that, thank you for the question, because there are some core concepts in the book, which we reused, but we also introduced some like local content. So it's the
in China,
the book is all about
mean?
In China. Yeah. So the point is that it's not just about the theories. People reading it have to feel that it applies to them, that it applies to their context. So if it also has local examples, local cases, it helps them in understanding how like the general concepts work and how they could be applied.
Because what made you study something that typically gets sort of like typified as very organic and not like every kind of case is more unique, they're trying to be. And so what made you choose to start like to study startups?
By the way, that's the easiest excuse not to kind of.
I realize, but it still is interesting.
But I believe that every startup even has like they have so much in common, and the whole process of actually the whole art of valuating companies and getting funding for those for those ventures, which is really a necessity for them to take off, has a lot of scientific and practical foundations, which apply for all ventures in general. So, what we do in the book is we really kind of differentiate between the kind of especially the stage of the venture, the venture development stage, and depending on the venture development stage, we indicate which would be typically the funding source they would be looking at and what the funding process would look like.
And what is something that bigger companies can learn from the startup scene and the finance part of that?
Nice question. So having scarce funding brings out the best in people. Yeah. So because you're looking for more creative ways to kind of still realize what you intended to realize, but do it another way.
Don't tell our management that.
And this disciplining role of capital, and that's what you also see investors do, because they typically tend to commit a certain amount, but they won't release the entire amount, to kind of keep that disciplining role for the entrepreneurs. While that's very hard to replicate in a corporate setting, because it's a much more comfortable setting, and the comfortable setting actually does not push people as much in that tendency to seek for creative solutions.
Henry and Letitia, you say traditional held beliefs on marketing needs revision.
Yes.
Can you explain what these traditional beliefs are or were?
Oh yes, if I may start, marketing is a subject that is like football, taxes, raising kids. We all know everything about it, but then we don't. And one of the most popular models in marketing, Kotler's 4P model, is I think pretty useless.
Still there?
Oh, it's still there. Still used. Everybody talks about it. And it's horrendous. It's horrendous. And that's one of the beliefs that we debunked a long time ago. And another thing that we found
in our... The P model sounds questionable already, but...
It is very questionable.
Triple P or...
4P.
4P.
And then you have to know that in 1960, Mr. McCarthy wrote a book in which he explained 44Ps. So,
wow.
Well, that's for the nerds among us.
We're not going into that.
No, not at all. Okay. And another thing that if you ask a marketeer, what's the most important question to solve? And they will probably say, how do you compete? But we found out that it's more where you compete. So which market, which segments. And that makes sense, because marketing should be done with the customer in mind. And the question...
Can you explain with an example?
Oh, yes, of course. Of course. So it is about where you compete. And in marketing, we think in segments. And a segment is a collection of companies or people that have a similar need. Now, I've done most of the research I've done in Western Europe. And typically, we see that in Western Europe, there's three reasons why companies and individuals buy. So that's the offering, it's the customer process, as we call it, and the image. And price, typically low price, is not that important in Western Europe. But I've done also the research in Africa, South Africa, and in Russia. And in Russia, there's two buying reasons very important.
Mm-hmm.
It's the offering and the low price.
Mm.
And in South Africa, goes without saying, it's low price. So it's definitely very important where you compete. That's the first and foremost thing that you have to solve. Yes.
No, what country? What area? What
not context? Only the country, but also the area, but also the type of segment that you are catering to.
Mm. That's very interesting. So where a company should compete rather than how.
That's right.
And create a positive and strong image and do not compete on price.
Yes, that's the recipe.
That's your recipe, right?
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yes. So what Hani and I tried to do, because his research is already well established. So what I tried to contribute here instead was a different type of tools that you use in marketing. So commonly what you will do, you will use questionnaires or surveys, focus group. But we know that there are some problems with this. So there are some implicit bias in how the question, for instance, are posed, or also what we notice very often.
I, of course, want an example.
Want an example, yes. I will give you an example about the consumers in this case. So when we ask what we like, right, sometimes we tend to give an answer based on what we think it's the reason, right? So, or we tend to even lie sometimes. Imagine if someone asks you something about a topic that you're very sensitive about, religion, for instance,
yeah,
or sexuality. So you might tend to lie when you answer, or even, yeah, I don't know.
Or exaggerate a little bit.
Or the biggest problem is sometimes you don't know why you actually like something. Right. And right, especially when it comes to brand. I mean, when it comes to product, you might say that you like the product, or for instance, an iPhone, because of the type of software that they use or the functionality, how it looks. Okay. But when it comes to a brand, that is much more difficult, mm-hmm, because the interaction with a brand is like it continues throughout your life. Right. So there are, yeah, multiple interactions. So how do you define brands like positive interaction or negative interactions? And that's where neuroscience tools come into place, because they give you a different understanding. It's not about asking consumers anymore, but it's about actually trying to study directly what is the unconscious reactions to these brands or products. And that's what we try to do here.
Is it for small businesses and large companies the same?
Yes, it is. It is, because what Henry and I try to do is actually look at how these neuroscience tools can be applied in marketing. And more specifically, we try to create a kind of classification of the tools they are currently used, because there's a lot of talk. And these tools can range, for instance, from eye tracking or fMRI, but they're also very invasive tools. So what we try to look at is, okay, what can you actually use and how can you use it? So create a classification, create a kind of mind map that small business as large business can both use. So it's really try to focus on what you can, like what is the best option for you for that specific issue. So for instance, about advertisement, about pricing. So there are many different tools that you can apply there.
Oh, and how did you guys come across neuromarketing? I'm really curious, because that's quite a different field from, I feel like, traditional marketing.
Oh yes. I think it really took off when Leticia arrived here at Nijnrode. So we started, and she brought in her expertise immediately. And before that, my first experience with neuromarketing was with a project where I was interested in whether we could apply neuromarketing techniques to a business-to-business application, because most of it done is in B2C. And so the idea was, can we predict the success of a strategic drug by interviewing these board members while they were in a scanner? And
what a cool project.
It was amazing. So every board member was videotaped. They were given questions about the new product. And each member, when they were in the scanner, they had to look at a video of 2 minutes in which their colleagues would explain things. And the first juicy thing was that the project was enormously delayed, because one board member was afraid to to go into the scanner. Because, you know, what happens if they find something?
Yeah.
And that's typical in that kind of research. Mm. So
no way to hide, right?
We pushed him in. So
We drugged him.
It's academic research. Come on. Give me the data. And so we completed the project. And all of the hypotheses that we had were disconfirmed. But we found some very relevant stuff. Through a certain kind of analysis, we could map the interpersonal distances among the board members.
Wow.
And there were two board members that they were very far from the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 weeks after the study, they were fired. But they hadn't seen the results. There is something there that we didn't understand, we didn't predict. But we found something very, very relevant.
And what exactly did you find? Because you look at the brain scans.
Yes.
And how the brain reacts to the video videos, of
the videos of the colleagues.
Of the colleagues.
That's right. So and then we saw that two colleagues were very distant from the CEO.
So this is board dynamics, basically.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Neuromarketing.
Yeah. But
and the edge of
we
were
looking
dynamics.
For that. We were totally naive on that. We were just looking on our hypotheses on the new product launch. And, well, it goes to show that was my first experience with a neuromarketing investigation.
It's very interesting. And also, it's interesting for the colleagues who work on boardroom dynamics, right?
That's right. That's
so
right.
How do you collaborate with other researchers and other
Well,
Leticia topics?
Does a... Among the two of us, she's the real expert. I'm a fake.
I thought so already.
Yes, of course. I saw you looking at me that way.
So you can answer the question.
Yes, that was. How would you?
It's his way to get rid of the question.
Dodgeable. Well, yes, we are, of course, collaborating with several companies, or at least trying to get companies involved as well in the research. And because in per se, this is a multidisciplinary field, right? So it comes from the combination of actually three different fields, which is marketing, psychology, and neuroscience. So you need experts that are able to understand a little bit of all three fields. So you always be in touch with, for instance, some colleagues from cognitive psychology or, for instance, institutes right. in which work with neuroscience. That's actually also what we did. So we did have collaboration with institutes in Italy and now also in the Netherlands.
And they can also use your results if you come across something that's really interesting to further research.
Sure.
Cool.
But do you... Because are you a neuroscientist in your background, or how did that happen? Because I feel like my brother is doing his PhD in neuroscience, and I don't understand a single thing he's doing. So that's why I'm curious, like, how do you go from such a more like business kind of thing to something quite technical?
Well, I think the starting point is always a question from business. And like Leticia explained, you know, there are so many traditional ways of doing a study that are completely biased, that it is relevant to do it in an unbiased way. And that's where these neuroscience tools come into play. So first and foremost, it's about business questions, business problems, looked at from a different point of view.
That is funny because I have an old belief on neuromarketing being it that you can use it as a tool to manipulate people.
You're on group dynamics, right? It's the same thing,
it's
right?
It's the same thing. That's why I'm asking.
Well, Leticia.
Yeah, okay, I'll take this. And, indeed, so that's a very common misconception about neuromarketing. And that comes also from the fact that a lot of companies do use these tools, but just in terms of consultancy, and sometimes they take shortcuts actually to design experiments. So there's this idea also that we kind of have a button in our brain that you can simply push and that automatically people will start buying.
You'll be a slave to
yes, exactly. There will
the
be
things that you
no
want
free
me to
will.
Buy.
Indeed, indeed. No free will whatsoever is a kind of scenario. I don't know. What's the name of the movie?
I don't know. What movie are you thinking of?
Orange Clock?
Orange Clock?
Is that
a correct?
Clockwork Orange. Yes, that's sorry.
Good one.
Yes, that one. So that's a kind of apocalyptic scenario, you know. That's like if we start using these tools, then eventually we will have no free wills. But that's very far away from the truth, because what we are trying to do is just to improve marketing strategies, just that you use different tools that we use from surveys, and just make it a little bit better for companies to understand how consumers react to consumers react to certain stimuli, and for instance, how you can engage them, and if a product can draw attention, what kind of emotions they have for these products, either negative or positive. But it's not about eventually influencing the consumers, no.
And how big is the online?
I'm very curious, because the field is extremely, extremely dynamic, I would say. It's like really developing, yeah? Because there's still so much we don't know about the brain itself. So I'm wondering, how can you make sense of the signals that come out of your brain?
And how do you know it's true?
How do you make that translation? Yeah, so you see the signals, and so how do you make the translation? Mm.
Indeed. So that's a very good question. So there's a lot that we don't know about the brain, also our physical reactions, the same. So what you're trying to do is like there are certain type of measurements, they're already been used for a very long time in psychology or neuroscience. They're kind of markers, for instance, what we call markers, they're very well established. And you know they are linked to certain cognitive processes, like for instance, attention, engagement, emotions.
Can you name one example?
So, for instance, if you think about in terms of attention, so how far you look, like how long you look at a certain product, or if that product, for instance, that particular product can catch your attention over the others. And so you can look at that. And or, for instance, your level of excitement when you see a product. So you can clearly see with some instruments that the level of arousal will go up and down. So you know that in that case, there's an emotional reaction to assert a particular product.
And I want to have a clear vision on how that works. So you would have maybe four packages of the same product and you experiment on what gives the best reaction?
You
something
can also
like
do
that?
It with wine, right?
Yes, we did.
That's a good topic.
Indeed. So that's a very good example. Yes, there are many different ways to do it. So one is like the safest one probably would be about comparing products. And it was mentioned actually one of the experiments that we did was with wines. And we compare four different labels of wines and then we see which one the consumers would prefer. So, and the funny thing that first of all, when I started doing the experiments, I was really scared I would not get any respondents. And as soon as I put that you had to taste wine, so immediately, there were so many requests. Cool. So that was nice. Once. And the second was that we found some pretty interesting results and that people sometimes say that they like a label. But one of the label that was the least preferred still draw a lot of attention. So that tells you something that sometimes. You
and
know,
why did it draw attention?
I would say because of the type of colors or shape of the bottle. So it was pretty different. So normally you would have your typical shape. So it's a little bit more puffy on the top, and
so it stands out.
It stands out.
Yeah. And no, nobody wanted to know. I want the most expensive wine. What is the price?
Well, the wines were like the price was not disclosed, but yes, indeed there was a different price. So somehow, still people end up preferring the most expensive wine
because they could see it from the etiquette or like the thing.
Yes, yeah, the label. Definitely, it looked a bit more expensive.
Which reminds me of one of the worst or the best wines I've had, like one of the worst labels, which I still don't understand. But I guess it was so bad. The labels. I still remember the label. Like it was like this
That's
pirate ship.
A good imprint,
ship.
Yeah. A bad experience.
Yeah.
In this next part of the podcast, Jan-Anne is out and about doing interviews on location. Let's go now to a special segment where we dive deeper into the work of the researchers.
So today I'm with Bart Bouvet.
Yeah, that's right.
Today I'm with Bart Bouvet, a strategy consultant who grew up internationally because of his family business, which worked all over the world that sparked his business interest. After finishing his executive MBA at Nairobi, he became a consultant at Floor Partners, a horticulture consultancy firm where he now supports passionate entrepreneurs with growth strategies and change management. But before that, he applied some of the cases that we discuss in our impact case with Henry Robbe. Welcome, Bart.
Yeah, well, thank you. So nice to be here.
Yeah, great to see you. And so first of all, do you have a green thumb?
Great question. Do I have a green thumb? Yeah, well, actually I do. I think so, yeah. I grew up in a business, so already from, about 5 years old, I was running around between my father's company, in between plants, seeds, stuff like that.
And do you have a favorite plant, or like what's your favorite thing about it?
Ah, my favorite plant. I guess that's the Ginkgo biloba. It's a tree from China, and I've seen that tree over there, which was about 1,200 years old. It's amazing, very impressive. And during the autumn, when I drove down here, I saw the autumn colors at Nairobi as well. It's always very nice to see. But the Ginkgo, it turns fury yellow almost. It's amazing.
So like in between yellow and orange.
Yeah,
or?
It's very bright colors and very nice to see. So it's one of my favorites.
That's amazing. And so how did you get involved into this impact case?
You mean from the marketing strategy analysis?
Yeah.
It was part of the MBA program, which I followed in between 2016 and 2018. And marketing strategy was an important part of the MBA and also one of the reasons why I chose for Nairobi. And at that time, I was working closely with IKEA for the company that I was working for at the time, a big plant exporting company in Europe. And as I mentioned, I think one of the ways I described it during the MSA was I had the feeling that we were in between BHAGs, the big, hairy, audacious goals. And when we started the business with IKEA back in 2008, we had this amazing, ambitious goal of getting the perfect supply chain. But after that, we never really reevaluated that ambition and the goals connected to that ambition. So at 2015, 2016, we really had to do something because we were a little bit too comfortable in the position that we had. And it's always quite tricky, especially with big retail companies. So from time perspective, this was actually very nice. It was perfect timing. So I could redefine our ambition in close collaboration with IKEA. So I could really talk to those guys over there, discuss my studies, my MBA, but also the specific assignment for marketing. And by doing so, get commitment from that company as well. So it was not just an idea in my head that I was able to visualize.
But you got to put it in practice.
Yeah. We were really able to put it in practice.
And so you say we got too comfortable. What was the spark that made you, I guess, wanting to be uncomfortable again and set those audacious goals? So for the people who are listening, BHAG is the big, hairy, audacious goals.
Yep.
And so it's basically being super ambitious.
Super ambitious. So the moment you feel like everything is comfortable and it's almost too easy, I guess that's the moment you start reevaluating your goals, and you can really be ambitious with those goals, because there's this nice saying, aim for the moon and you'll find yourself among the stars. In practice, it really works like that. So just put your goals very ambitious, and it will make sure that by the end of a few years, you really developed the business further and much more than you would anticipate it in the beginning.
And what was the key shift for you guys at the company?
The key shift? The business with IKEA was almost an example business case for our company. So we learned a lot from that collaboration. At the same time, the collaboration was very, very cost-driven. So there was a lot of focus on product costs. And in order to develop the partnership between our company and that of IKEA, we had to also shift the focus a little bit towards more value-based collaboration. And that you can do that in a cautious way. So you should not put too much focus on an amazing, great shift from cost-driven to value-driven. But you can do that by discussing the opportunities together with your customer and showing that there's much more connected to the value for the end customer than purely the product cost. So it's about end-to-end solutions, making sure that you can develop the customer experience for the products that we supplied to IKEA, but also look what we can do more for the company. So, and that's also something that this marketing strategy analysis helped me to do. So, just to clarify a little bit, the MSA was focused on putting your ambitions on paper. So your B Act that you just mentioned, it's a clear vision. You can visualize it, you can describe it, but then the journey starts. So of course you can have a vision in your head, but you need to be able to share it as well. So you need to understand where you are today. So what made you as a person or as a department, as a team, as a company.
And where you want to go.
Yeah, and where you want to go. So then you got a clear picture of, all right, this is what we're doing right now. But in the future, our competitive advantage is not merely what we're doing now, but we need to do something extra. We need to develop certain areas of expertise. And by describing those areas, you start thinking about how to get there. So you can,
and that starts affecting change within the company.
That starts affecting a change within the company, but also in between the relationship with your customer. Because if you're only cost-driven and all the conversations are about costs and price development,
it stays very transactional as a relationship.
Yeah, it stays transactional and it limits the potential of the relationship, but also of the potential of all the parties involved in that business. So as a company, we were the main supplier for IKEA in Europe, but behind us, or I should say together with us, there were about 150 growers connected and
wow,
thinking about how they can improve the business with IKEA. And you can only do that, in my opinion, by looking at the true value that you can offer to your customers, to IKEA, but also how you can create value for your own company, of course.
Yeah, it gets more collaborative.
It gets more collaborative. And that's also something that the MSA focus on, of course. You need to make sure that you create value for the customer, but also for your own company, because otherwise it's not a sustainable business.
Yeah, great. I have one more question. And that is in the impact case, they say that traditional health beliefs need revision. And so what is a belief that changed for you during your time here?
For the MBA or for the MSA, you mean?
Either or, but more the strategy. What changed your mind on strategy?
Ah, what changed
What shifted?
I think the point, the thing that I pointed out just a minute ago, that you need to focus on value creation for both your customer and yourself. It's something that really triggered me to be customer centric, but also keep in mind what is important to you and what is important for the actors in the supply chain. So it's something that you're doing together as a network, as an ecosystem. And if you understand that, you can also create more value for all those involved, I think. And that's something that really triggered me also during the MBA and during the MSA.
Great. And lastly, we've talked about the BHAG. What's your personal BHAG?
My personal BHAG. Well, I'd love to be able to develop more expertise within the company that I'm currently working for, to make sure that we really become a thought leader on the areas of strategy, transformation, but also personal development, leadership. Those are elements, I think, that will become crucial for future developments for making sure that the companies within our network, at least, are able to make a positive impact towards the future. And I'd love to be part of that.
Great. Positive impact and creating value. I think that wraps it up for now. Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me and look forward to next time.
So, what job? How is your work related with neuromarketing?
With neuromarketing, not that much, but with wine, maybe more.
Okay, no, let's change the subject then.
Yeah. No. So, actually, my work is not directly related to neuromarketing. I'm actually thinking about like how could this tool or this toolbox or this new field, how could that be applied to my field?
I can tell
my
you.
My field of entrepreneurial finance.
I can tell you.
Oh wow.
I would say just invite a couple of business angels into such a scanner and then let them evaluate some potential projects from entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
That would be one.
Those pitches. Yeah. So you could have like the typical Dragon's Den setting.
Mm.
Yeah.
For
so
instance,
you would have a number of pitches and then you would see like how they would actually react like really as opposed to how they react like verbally towards one another, right?
That's one thing. And another thing might be that you simply show them the proposal in the scanner and see where something happens or happens in the brain, where
that's
they react
really interesting.
To. And because we think that when people evaluate a proposal, that they are very rational, that they do this, that, and the other, but it may be a bit different. It may be that certain words or placements create excitement.
There's actually the point, especially in those early stage ventures, what you see is that it's typically less about the proposal itself. It's much more about what they call the jockey. It's less about the horse. It's more about the jockey.
Hmm.
So what we see is, and that will be really, really interesting, is like to see how so the jockey stands for the entrepreneur. The horse stands for the venture.
So they're looking more into like, is this a quality person that I can trust with my money?
Is this someone that would make, because is that someone I would trust with my money, would make the right decisions for the business, for our joint interest to go to be furthered.
What my interest would be then, if they can say, well, I like this person better, but they will have a choice of words to explain that. If you put them in the scanner, you might come to a different conclusion for their motivation.
For sure. I could really.
You just want
to
put anyone into the scanner, right?
Yeah.
Where is that thing? Maybe we could.
The one thing I'm curious about the financing of startups and entrepreneurs, you start to see. You often see, for example, I think it was the case with WeWork, who were like really overvalued and ultimately didn't have anything to back it up with. Do you think that's a trend that will keep on going? Or is that, how do you see that within the European market?
So WeWork, wasn't that Tencent? It was one of their biggest shareholders,
so.
Right?
Yeah.
And what you see now, I can't really relate to the case of WeWork, but what you see now is that there's really a competition for the nice ventures and the nice entrepreneurs, right? So it's very much about people, like investors are looking for serial entrepreneurs, are looking for ventures, and especially ventures early stage. So noticing those ventures earlier on in the venture development process is something that is something I tend to see in
and how's that so? Like, what makes them? Is that just because they get more value from their investment?
For sure, more value. Mm. Great suggestion. So for sure, they would get more value because the earlier they get in, the more expensive their money is for the entrepreneur, but the less expensive their share is for the investors. It's also about kind of getting close to the entrepreneurs and help them kind of sense and respond. So sense the markets with their proposition and help them respond better. So investors typically bring quite some experience with them as well.
Yeah.
It's not about the money. So all the process.
The angel investors, mostly.
For instance, an angel investor or venture capitalist, but typically, let's talk about business angels.
Like, they want to keep themselves busy, so they also want to.
it's more than just money. That's right.
It's more than just money.
It's also like an engagement. It's also like a sense of contributing. It's a sense of
right.
Maybe giving back, but the forms of funding that I describe, especially the early stage funding, is so much more than about the funding itself. It's actually more about the smartness of the money. It's more about the people that bring the funding. So that's what you also see at the entrepreneurs, that entrepreneurs tend to be more critical about who is bringing me the money. It's not just like the expression is not everyone's money is green, right?
Mm.
So it's not just any money that I will accept. I would like to have an investor on board which also contributes to my venture and which contributes to me as a person, because it's not the money that makes the difference. It's actually the choice you will make along the way that will define whether we are success or not. And this kind of more critical attitude towards what kind of investors we bring on board is something I think we see as well.
As a positive development.
Exactly. Well, here's an opportunity for your company.
Yeah.
To help investors and entrepreneurs create a certain dynamics in which they get to know each other better,
right,
in a relevant sense.
Right. And we put them in the scanner first, and then I'll so on topic, because there's lots of scale-up companies that I work with, and they all have the same problem in their growth.
Well, you see here, this could be a nice solution for this very relevant problem.
And one of the things that I totally agree with is the trust you need to have when you are a startup or scale-up, in your scale-up phase, is it's not like, oh, well, please fund me in my company, but there's also the funding partner wants something in return. And it's very good to critically, not only what does the money come from, but also who am I engaging with? What are the demands of the funding party?
Yeah, so because I think you're very spot on again. The point is that if we get like entrepreneurs and investors, if we connect those, if like investors really invest in this venture, these two are really connected, right? So it's something that's very particular, because the investment is extremely illiquid, so we can't trade it, we can't get rid of it, and we're kind of bound to one another. So as investor and an entrepreneur, you're bound to one another. You'll have to make it work together. It goes from the personality to the experience, to the network, to
Have you ever seen bad examples where the whole thing just backfired or was a wrong match
between investor and entrepreneur?
Yeah.
I'm thinking right now, but what I would typically see is maybe the investor kind of taking too much of a hands-off approach. While in fact, entrepreneurs are typically looking for this more hands-on approach, and like for more than the money. And that's something.
It's a thin line, though, because you don't want too much of the.
That's why you became an entrepreneur, right? You don't want too much involvement either. That's right.
And you probably have an advisory board as well.
Yes.
So you have lots of people that want to mingle with your affairs, so to speak.
Yeah. But that's right. And so that'll be a challenge for the entrepreneur and like dealing with all the stakeholders. But the fun part so at the same time, there's a fun part from like an investor point of view. It's so much more, and startup entrepreneurial finance is so much more than kind of funding Ben van Beurden Shell, right?
Mm.
It's like the distance is so big, while here the distance is so close. It's like we can touch each other, we can talk to each other, we can actually influence the direction of the company, and that's the fun for the investors and for the entrepreneur. But You're right, Brechtje. It's finding that thin line of walking that thin line on where do I leave the entrepreneur be the entrepreneur and make the choices that he or she would like to do, as opposed to forcing my investor experience upon him or her, right? So I see Henry is very, you had a point as well, right? You
want to? Yeah, I was involved with this nice startup in Delft. And I was sort of an advisor. I'm not an investor. And the two people leading the company, very bright engineers, of course, and they were looking for funds. And one of my friends invested. And then there were a couple of rounds where they needed more money. And there was this guy who said, you know, I'm now investing so many millions. But that means this and the other. So he wanted to have influence. And there things began to start shaking. Mm. And especially because he didn't know the business, he didn't have the money.
Oh.
So for the final round, he had to fork out
withdraw.
Yeah, and he didn't kind of do it. So, but this was typically someone, and the red flag was, I want to have influence in this company without knowing what it was about.
Right. A red flag indeed.
And to zoom out a little bit, because we're also here for the impact cases and the book writing. What's the, and we clearly have people passionate about the topic, but what made you start, like, made you want to write a book? For you, of course, Jop, it was that you didn't find anything useful for the European market, but was there anything else that sparked it?
I think that, like, the second argument is like that books is not a way for teachers to tell what they can, to tell the students what they know, but it's actually much more a means to get the interaction going. So what we intended to do with our book is actually make it a means toward an interaction, because I'm a strong believer of the pull instead of the push. So I don't believe in the push of professors or teachers telling the students what they should know, because they can probably read it. It's very much more like the class setting is very much more about creating a pool. It's about having those triggers, and it's the engagement of so triggering or getting the fascination of those students, and thereby kind of really get them engaged. Mm. And that's what we aspire to do. And but I think we've been able to at least do better than what was available at the time.
I mean, clearly so with the amounts of places where it gets taught.
Yes.
So yeah, for
yes,
sure.
Thank you.
And with marketing mit Balle, marketing with balls, why would you like marketeers to grow a pair?
Because inherently most marketeers are cowards. And
it's a good, solid firm statement.
Come do marketing in Nijrode.
Do you consider yourself a marketeer?
Oh, yes. Okay. And I am a coward. And typically, they don't speak the language of the boardroom finance. So they need to speak finance. But the thing is, why you write books? Because I think a book is, in fact, a very creative synthesis of your research and teaching. And when you look at my books, they've all been based on research.
Yeah.
Where some people just write stories, we can show, well, this is really happening. We have a foundation of data and analysis to show that we know what we're talking about. But in essence, book writing is very satisfying and rewarding, because it is your research, you know what you're talking about. It's your teaching, and you know what you're talking about. So the effect is, you know what it is, and you can convince people because of your research, knowledge, and consultancy experience.
You can show an insight of your work.
Yes.
And a certain message that you want to get across.
Yes.
Yeah.
Certainly so.
Satisfying indeed. How about you?
Well, I haven't written any book so
far. You have a plan.
Well, I'm thinking about it, but you know, the point is that I'm still not over yet my PhD thesis. So
still recovering.
How traumatic was that?
Yeah. Yes, it was very traumatic. So, and of course, like, you cannot really generate knowledge on the spot. So I think it should be at least a 5 years gap between the two. So then I think I will start with something small, probably, if I really had to, because now we have started to introduce new marketing as a topic also in our courses, like for the BC. Mm. So in that sense, maybe a small booklet for the students would be nice.
Good. We'll be waiting for that.
What would be one tip you guys have for when she writes her book in 5 years?
Okay, well, first, more research, more publications. That gives you credence with a publisher, because most publishers don't do anything for you, right? They just print the book.
How true.
Take the
no
margin.
Marketing.
Take the margin. And you know. So write more research papers, get them well published, and get a few companies to work with for the business examples. Mm. Because in my books, it's the combination of research and business examples that really brings the message home.
Maybe to add to that. So my publisher, Cambridge, was my funder. So what I did is actually I just developed this idea together with Luisa, and we said like, how would our ideal book look like? And then we just developed the table of contents, like these 18 chapters. Mm. And then we thought like, hey, but this field is quite rapidly developing, so it's quite young, and it has a number of experts, but there's not one person that holds it all, that knows it all. So what we did, and that may be a suggestion for Letitia, is like seek experts in the field with whom you can collaborate, because that's what we did. It's like we thought those experts in the field, but before that we actually pitched it to Cambridge and said like, this is the book we'd like to write. We don't know how it's going to look yet, but these are the topics, and they liked our approach. So they liked the approach. So that's why they got involved. And then we could use the name Cambridge again towards our contributors, as we call them. So the suggestion is seek those partnerships. And I would actually go seek also your preferred publisher early on, especially on the footprint this publisher has, because that was the main goal, was to get the message out there. And this was our preferred footprint, one.
What's that for people who are listening who don't understand?
Footprint is the footprint actually relates to the reputation of the publisher and in
the markets. What markets?
In what markets this publisher has its footprint. Has its customers. Yeah? So for instance, Cambridge is very known in universities, so they have their leaflet there, and they have their representatives there going there.
So
that helps to get the message out.
Thank you so much, because on the topic of writing textbooks, we have a couple of good advices now we can work with. Jan Anna and I would really like to know if we have left some questions that we didn't ask you that you still want to answer.
Yes. When is your new book coming out?
my new book. Well, last week. My new book.
What's the title?
Maybe this book, Hybride Teams, Hybrid Teams. But my new book, maybe I need to set a new goal, maybe in a year. Because this one lasted me 10 years from the first one. So it's a big...
Well, it's not bad. Most people don't write any books in their lives, so
that's true.
It's a quite an accomplishment.
Well, let me ask. Thank you so much. Let me ask Jan Anna. When is your book coming out?
When is my book coming out? Not anytime soon. No, I'm still busy with my master's. But honestly, hearing all these ideas, I'm like, I would love to do something with business and see how it relates. But I still am finding my niche.
I'm curious. And you guys, are you working on something new?
Sure.
Can you tell me a little bit more about
there's,
it?
There's at least two projects. So one book I'm writing with Rudy Munard from Tilburg and Michael Antioco from EDEC in France. And this book will be on creating great businesses. And it will be about marketing without marketing in the title. Because one of my objectives is to get rid of marketing in every business school. because we need a different topic. We need a different subject. It will be marketing, but we shouldn't call it marketing because marketing is associated with some negative ideas.
These and days. Will there be...
You
go.
It's so to make it more integrated.
Yes.
As what you're saying is like they need to talk to boardroom talk.
That's right. That's right. Mm. And when that's finished, I will try to finish my first novel as soon as possible.
Wow. Well, back to the first, I want to know a little bit more about the novel, but is there any daunting title we can expect? A bold
one? Oh, yes.
One?
It's called, well, bold. I'm not sure whether it's bold.
Well, marketing met Ballen was
a
bold
that
one.
Was a bit bold, yes. Yes. We are going to call this book The Customer Leader.
Wow, it's a whole new...
And what's the title of your novel?
Oh, the working title is so I haven't decided on the right title, but the working title is Naivety is a Sympathetic Form of Stupidity.
I love it already. Now you still have to write it.
I'm writing the novel, but the title I'm not sure about.
Okay. So I love the title. Stick with it.
Stick with it. Cool. How about you?
I'm actually in the process of, we've kind of finalized our book in China, and we're in the process of now developing a book for Latin America. Again, with the same concept, and now it'll be Spanish. So what you see there is that the books in Latin America, especially the business books, tend to be English. Mm. And we're working on a Spanish book with similar but localized content help those entrepreneurs bridge the divide between thinking about nice things and actually doing it.
Working on world domination with your book.
Yes, please.
Well, I think it's also a perfect illustration when you talk about China adaptation, Latin America adaptation, is the perfect illustration of the principle of where to compete, right?
Yes, it is.
Because you're not doing it in America, I guess.
No.
So
because we're not doing it in North America because there's no point. Yeah. So that's yes.
So I think we can talk for hours still. We have to wrap it up, but thank you so much, Job, Henry, and Letitia, and we'll be waiting for your new books to come out.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good, excellent. Enjoyed it. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much.